Hello and welcome back to Food Toxicology. Well, today's lecture, what we're going to try to do is look at foodborne disease, but foodborne disease from seafood and shellfish. In fact, today's lecture, we're going to talk about marine toxins in food, the sources, the pathways, the receptors, and the controls, not only the physiological controls, but some of the regulatory controls in terms of keeping our food system safe. The learning objectives here today, what we're going to do first is we're going to try to understand somewhat the linkage between marine algal toxins, the so-called red tides or hazardous algal blooms, and how they have a relationship to human food poisoning. We'll try as well to look at some other seafood-based food poisonings that deal with toxins that are produced by various marine species. One of these, we're going to look at scomboid fish poisoning. We've reviewed this a little bit in terms of the chemistry of scomboid fish poisoning, and we did a case study on this. We'll try to examine it in terms of its scope within the U.S. food system. We'll also examine a very interesting neurotoxin involved in Ciguatera fish poisoning. This is quite interesting, not only from its biochemical mode of action, but also in the range of fish and the presentation of clinical disease. We'll try to then talk about at length various shellfish poisonings. You read about these in the media on a reasonable occasion in terms of numbers of times per year in the media. This is something that is unfortunately far too common, and again, this is because of the transport of marine toxins in the ocean environment. We'll try to understand paralytic shellfish poisoning, or PSP, neurotoxic shellfish poisoning, and also diuretic shellfish poisoning, and a final category of encephalopathic or amnesiac shellfish poisoning. All of these have a different presentation of disease, and their causation factor is different as well. We'll then transfer back into toxins produced by fish, and we'll examine fugu poisoning or tetrodotoxin in the human food supply. We'll finish up exploring some other marine toxins of minor, but no less uncomfortable, if you will, outcomes in terms of marine-borne toxins. Well, in terms of where to start, what we have found in our analysis of ecological biochemistry is that species are in a battle, a struggle, if you will, for survival, and marine animals are no different. They will produce secondary metabolites and secondary compounds in a very similar fashion as the plant kingdom, although sometimes these are venoms or they are strategies in terms of prey capture or defense mechanisms, or in some cases they're actually pheromones. They actually have a bio-relationship in terms of production of the species. We, because of our knowledge, accumulated knowledge over the centuries, tend to avoid many of the marine species that have high levels of toxicants. And typically what you find in foodborne, seafoodborne disease is accumulations, not necessarily a dietary use of a toxic species. Starfish, sea cucumbers, various types of mollusks are all can be considered as overtly toxic in terms of the types of toxins they do provide. Now, what we find is that there are poisonings in terms of epidemiological study, and there are major public episodes that can be dozens to hundreds of individuals. On a case outbreak basis. These do present some health issues in terms of long-term impacts. Some of these have severe economic impact in terms of the fishing and shellfish industry. If, for example, red tide or a public health episode is noticed, essentially the consuming public stops consuming that particular food product. There is a severe impact on marine life in terms of fish kills associated with hazardous algal blooms, harmful algal blooms that do occur, these red tides. About 14% of all foodborne outbreaks are associated with some sort of marine toxin. Now, the major causes of seafood-borne illness include live mollusk and shellfish, and most of these are actually associated with microbiological, either bacterial from Vibrio species or Norwalk-like viruses. But we do find that these shellfish can accumulate natural marine toxins, and that's what we're going to talk to today. We'll also find, in terms of major causes, scomboid fish poisoning and ciguatera is unfortunately fairly prevalent in terms of the whole of seafood-borne illness. What are the concentrations or the estimated U.S. cases per year? In terms of scomboid fish poisoning and ciguatera, they're significant relative to the overall estimated cases. And this is the differentiation between reported cases, where we actually have clinical diagnostic intervention and we actually do a case workup and have a report of that particular disease instance. This estimation comes at people that have some sort of seafood-borne illness but don't go as far as visiting a health institution like a hospital or a physician, and therefore it goes unreported. What this might be is that they have mild self-resolving symptoms. It may put them down or give them a tummy ache for a couple of days, but no long-term impacts. But in terms of the estimated cases for scomboid fish poisoning, 8,000 per year. Ciguatera, about 1,800. These are significant levels of human disease. In terms of natural marine toxins that we're going to take a look at again today, scomboid fish poisoning, where we talked about previously the role of histamine in essentially presenting a histamine response in an individual and significant level of illness. Ciguatera fish poisoning, a neurotoxin, quite a bit more significant in terms of its potential and potential lethality. Shellfish toxins of the four categories that we are going to describe, some of them being potentially lethal, other being just a nuisance, a couple of days of illness. Tetrodotoxin is another marine toxin that may have, in significant concentration, a fatal outcome because of its neurotoxicity. We'll also talk about gemplotoxin. This is a toxin. It's rarely fatal. It's an uncomfortable diarrheic. And then we'll finish up with a discussion of Pfisteria and how this particular marine toxin-induced fish disease may actually have some concern in terms of seafood-borne illness. Now, scomboid fish poisoning is named for the family of fish, the tuna and mackerels, which are one of the prime vectors of this particular fish poisoning. If you recall our case study we did in a previous lecture, that involved restaurants serving a tuna salad, and that tuna salad, in terms of HACCP tracking, was traced back through the distribution and supply system to the Gulf of Mexico from longline fishing. This particular fish poisoning can actually involve any fish that might contain high levels of free histidine. And what happens in these particular fish is the histidine is broken down into histamine. On the next slide, you can see the role of the enzymatic conversion for histamine formation. The other class of amines that comes with microbial infectious process or improper handling in terms of temperatures and with involved with seafood are the production of the catabolic metabolic products, cadaverine and putrescine. These are the putrefying chemicals. Some people also have allergic reactions to these particular amine compounds. Scomboid fish poisoning, the source, again, is improperly handled, and that can be time, temperature, or abuse. Fish such as mahi-mahi, tuna, bluefish, sardines, and mackerel. The range of this particular disease is worldwide. Its onset, it's immediate, about 30 minutes after consumption of the material, depending upon the histamine levels, depending upon the other vasopressive amines that might be associated with the particular fish product. The initial symptoms include tingling or burning sensation in the mouth, can present as a rash on the upper body, an allergic rash, drop in blood pressure, headache, itching of the skin. Later symptoms will include nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea. The duration in terms of the course of this particular disease, about 3 hours to several days, depending upon the amount ingested and the sensitivity of the individual. In terms of treatment, standard antihistamine therapy is used. The controls in terms of HACCP type controls, proper chilling and temperature control is important. The FDA guideline in terms of histamine concentrations, 50 parts per million. In terms of scomboid poisoning outbreaks, the CDC tells us that about 5% of all foodborne outbreaks are reported, and 37% of all seafood-related borne illnesses are associated with scomboid poisoning. There's about approximately 200 outbreaks involving nearly 1,400 people between the years of 1973 to 1987. Between 1988 and 1997, there were 145 reported outbreaks, and these involved 811 persons in 20 states. Typically, the states involved are coastal states with higher levels of fresh fish consumption, including Hawaii, Florida, California, the state of Washington, New York, and Connecticut, although this can happen almost anywhere with the food distribution system. The next type of marine toxin we're going to talk about is Ciguatera and Ciguatera fish poisoning. This is the most commonly reported marine toxin disease in the world. It is associated with the consumption of reef fish. These reef fish, especially higher on the aquatic food chain, bioaccumulate this particular toxin. This disease affects 50,000 people per year worldwide, giving them debilitating neurologic symptoms, including some profound weakness, temperature sensation, pain, numbness in the extremities. This can clear up in a couple of days in low dose, or in the event of consumption of some organ meats associated with fish, it can lead actually to fatality. There are four toxins associated with Ciguatera. They're complex structures. The source of the toxin is certain species of fish that feed on a algae species. Gambardiscus is the main vector in terms of these dinoflagellates. The range is in tropical and subtropical waters worldwide, but again, because of the distribution system of many fish species, there is the potential for impact no matter where you live. In the U.S., the East Coast, Puerto Rico, Hawaii, and the Virgin Islands in terms of the amount of fresh fish that is consumed. Ciguatera toxin is heat stable, and so cooking does not remove it. The dinoflagellate Gambardiscus toxicus is again one of the major vectors. This image on this particular slide shows you the 20 micron size domain of this particular dinoflagellate. The two most common toxins associated with Ciguatera are ciguatoxin and mitotoxin. These are some of the most lethal substances known. They have an LD50 in mice, and this is intraperitoneal, in other words, injected into the abdomen. Intraperitoneal LD50 of 0.45 micrograms per kilogram. So this is a very toxic substance. This particular toxin is lipid soluble. What it does, it's a neurotoxin. It opens up the voltage-dependent sodium channels in cell membranes, and it then induces membrane depolarization. And again, the most toxic parts of the fish, typically the liver, kidneys, and the gonads, can be lethal if eaten. This again is heat stable. This gives you an idea of what this polyether macrolide looks like in terms of ciguatoxin. It's a fairly complex molecule. The dinoflagellate Gambardiscus toxicus is shown on this slide as well. In terms of how this poisoning happens, the ciguatoxin actually magnifies up the food chain. And so here's an example of a chemical compound, and this is primarily because it is lipophilic. It magnifies up the food chain in terms of some of the species that feed on directly on the algae that then become prey for the larger carnivores. In terms of the concentrations that present the humans, the larger carnivorous fish are typically considered to be the primary vectors. On this slide, we show you a Ciguatera fish poisoning warning poster in terms of the types of species, the range of species that Ciguatera is most associated with. In terms of its presentation, its onset is less than 6 hours. The symptoms, GI symptoms, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea. Neurological is numbness and tingling around the mouth. There can be some joint pain and aches, headaches, loss of temperature control. In other words, hot things seem cold, cold things seem hot. In terms of cardiovascular impacts, arrhythmia, bradycardia, rapid heartbeat, tachycardia, reduced blood pressure, all significant in terms of the health of the individual. The duration of Ciguatera fish poisoning is self-limiting within a couple of days. Rarely, some neurological symptoms may persist for months or years in impacted individuals. This is certainly dose dependent. The treatment is typically symptomatic in terms of trying to treat the symptoms, make sure that, for instance, respiratory function is maintained. The control in terms of how we examine fish that will be in trade is using a mouse bioassay. This is a very quick dose response in terms of Ciguatera fish poisoning. There are test kits available using enzyme immunoassay that take about 10 minutes, so people that are in food production for these types of fish can do fairly rapid and, I would say, fairly inexpensive. These are only about $5 per test. One of the ways to avoid Ciguatera fish poisoning is to obtain fish far from safe, far from impacted areas. Some of the commonly implicated species include those higher trophic level fish like groupers, barracudas, snappers, mackerel, triggerfish, the ones that are predatory, and in some cases game fish in terms of anglers that go out on fishing boats. The FDA guideline in terms of Ciguatera is there is none. It's an opportunistic sort of marine toxin that is found in these types of species. In terms of the numbers of reported outbreaks, 1981, Puerto Rico, 49 cases and 2 deaths, including the fish barracuda, amberjack, and blackjack. 1987, the Caribbean, 57 cases associated with fish casserole. In 1988, there were greater than 100 cases associated primarily with hogfish. 1992 in California, 25 cases. In 94, several cases, and in 95, there was a seaweed-associated Ciguatera outbreak. The next segment, we're going to talk about a fairly large impact in terms of seafood safety, and this is shellfish toxicity. There are 4 categories of shellfish toxicity: paralytic, neurologic, diarrheal, and amnestic shellfish poisonings. The toxins in terms of shellfish toxicity are found in these microscopic diatoms and dinoflagellates, and what happens is the concentrations increase in filter feeding bivalves such as clams or mollusks. There is limited correlation in terms of harmful algal blooms or red tides. The preferred terminology is HAB, or harmful algal blooms, although in the media you'll hear more often it referred to as a red tide. One of the reasons that's sometimes incorrect is because sometimes these blooms are not red at all. The harmful algal blooms actually contain the toxins. It's just that the bloom itself and the report of outbreaks don't necessarily correlate, and so there's other biodynamics involved in human exposure. In terms of harmful algal blooms, most of these are due to dinoflagellates, and these are unicellular microscopic phytoplankton. They have plant and animal properties. They're motile. They have chloroplasts. We find that they have a fairly high toxin layer level, and this is due to their own ecological biochemistry in terms of their survival and feeding on prey. Plankton feeders, shellfish, what they do is they are filter feeders. So they filter it from the water, and what happens is it accumulates up the food chain. What triggers red tides or harmful algal blooms? These are multifactorial. Scientists have linked it to nutrients like nitrogen and phosphorus in the environment, various types of metals, vitamins that occur in water, water temperature, water pH, various conditions such as calm conditions that allow for these large colonies to accumulate in the water surface. It can happen in pristine waters and not necessarily impacted waters in terms of, for example, discharge of sewerage or industrial municipal wastewater. Where do red tides occur? These harmful algal blooms have a worldwide distribution. The type of dinoflagellate varies with geographical area. You can see its particular impact here in terms of seashore in this particular image. There is a seasonal correlation in terms of warmer conditions, May to October in the west and July to September in the east. There's all sorts of wives' tales about not eating shellfish in, for example, months that begin with R. These have been disproven in terms of their reality, in terms of seafood safety. In terms of the major U.S. hazardous harmful algal bloom-related events, you can read through this slide in terms of the range of all the different shellfish poisoning, Ciguatera, Fisteria, brown tide, and all sorts of, as well, marine animal kills associated with harmful algal blooms. You can see that there is a little bit of diversity in terms of West Coast presentation and East Coast in terms of the Atlantic versus the Pacific. But one thing can be said, where there's people and where there's a coast, there are harmful algal bloom related poisoning events. In terms of the vector for this particular marine toxin, shellfish, again, are the vector. They're filter feeders, so we find it in clams, oysters, various mollusks, and scallops. This compromises about 7% of all marine intoxications. The toxins are heat stable, so eating raw versus cooked does not modify your exposure potential, whereas in bacterial disease, it would. It has little effect on the host itself in terms of the health of the filter feeders. The mortality rates vary depending upon the type of case, the amount of ingestion, and the sensitivity of the individual exposed. It can range from 8% to 23% across all shellfish toxicity. About 6% require some hospitalization, perhaps ventilation and life support as well, and some of the neurotoxic marine toxins. There are four major syndromes, PSP or paralytic shellfish poisoning. There's neurotoxic shellfish poisoning, diarrheatic shellfish poisoning, encephalopathic or amnesic shellfish poisoning is the final. And not only does it impact humans in terms of exposure in the human food chain, these poisoning outbreaks occur in fish, birds, and mammals associated with marine environments. PSP is the most common. It's the most severe in its presentation and has the most fatalities associated with it. CDC suggests about 10 per year in terms of U.S. Citizens dying of paralytic shellfish poisoning. Its source is in the dinoflagellates, Alexandrium, which is not readily visible, so this is where the harmful algal bloom, rather than red tide, actually makes more sense in terms of the designation of a vector pathway. The actual toxin is saxitoxin. It's a sodium channel blocker. It also is heat stable. The next slide gives you an idea of what the structure of the satotoxin toxins look like. There's about 12 to 20 analogs, and they differ in terms of various groups on the molecule all having the same basic structure. In terms of the source of paralytic shellfish poisoning, it comes from these contaminated shellfish feeding on the various algae of the Alexandrium, Pyridinium, and Gymnodinium species. The range is tropical to temperate waters worldwide. This colored graphic of Florida shows you some harmful algal blooms associated with the state of Florida. In terms of its onset, PSP presents in about a half an hour to a couple hours. The symptoms include tingling, burning, numbness, drowsiness, incoherent speech, sometimes respiratory paralysis in large-scale presentation. The duration will require respiratory support. If the patient is treated with respiratory support, usually we have a full recovery in a few days to a few weeks. With high-dose PSP, the presentation is difficulty swallowing, difficulty breathing, respiratory paralysis, and without medical intervention, death early as 3 to 12 hours following this particular ingestion. The case fatality rate in this case is about 5%. Now, in terms of the controls that we have on PSP, we have the mouse bioassay, a direct injection, see if the mouse dies bioassay. There's also a 10-minute enzyme assay and HPLC laboratory tests associated with follow-up analysis. And typically, this is epidemiological or follow-up monitoring after an outbreak of PSP. One of the controls is to monitor various coastal waters and shellfish for PSP toxins. And another is the control of just obtaining these particular food substances from approved waters. The FDA guideline in terms of saxitoxin is about 0.8 part per million saxitoxin equivalents, which translates to about 80 micrograms per 100 grams in all fish materials. In terms of the outbreaks of PSP, 1975 to 1989, we saw 42 outbreaks in Alaska. We saw in 1980, 98 cases in California and 2 deaths from oysters. In Massachusetts, 6 cases associated with mussel consumption. In Alaska in 1990, 11 cases. This gives you an idea of the year-to-year variability of the outbreaks associated with paralytic shellfish poisoning. The next category is neurotoxic shellfish poisoning. This is similar to PSP, although milder. It's associated with a dinoflagellate, Carinia brevis. The toxin in neurotoxic shellfish poisoning is brevetoxin. This also is a sodium channel blocker. It's not as potent as in the case of PSP, saxitoxin. Brevetoxin is also a polyether macrolid. This gives you an idea of what the polyether brevetoxins look like. There's about 6 different derivatives. There is a variability in terms of the toxicity of each of those derivatives. The source of the neurotoxin in neurotoxic shellfish poisoning is shellfish feeding on algae such as Gymnodinium brevi. The range is Gulf of Mexico and the southern Atlantic coast in the U.S., New Zealand. The toxins also are heat stable, so here's an instance as well where cooking is not going to detoxify the food material. Its onset is a few minutes to a few hours. The symptoms also include tingling and numbness of the lips and tongue, some muscular aches, dizziness, again, the cold-hot reversal associated with some of these neurotoxic effects, similar to ciguatera poisoning, same mode of action, the diarrhea and vomiting as well. The duration is a few hours to several days, and it's rare to have a fatality from this particular toxin. The controls associated with a safe food supply include mice bioassays, HPLC analyses, commercial immunoassay test kits, and as well just obtaining these shellfish from approved water. The FDA guideline for brevetoxin equivalents is 0.8 parts per million or 20 mouse units per 100 grams in clams, mussels, and oysters. In terms of neurotoxic shellfish poisoning, the outbreaks are sporadic and they occur in the U.S. Along the Gulf Coast of Florida, North Carolina, and Texas. I put a picture here of manatee. In 1996, there was a substantial outbreak of brevetoxin lethality in manatees. 150 of this particular endangered species was killed by brevetoxin. The next category of shellfish poisoning is diuretic. Shellfish poisoning happens more often in Europe and Japan. It's associated with the dinoflagellates Dinophysis and Prorocentrum. The toxin in terms of diuretic shellfish poisoning is okadaic acid derivatives. It occurs within minutes to hours of exposure. In terms of the clinical profile, 92% of the people experience diarrhea, 80% nausea, vomiting in 79% of the clinical presentations. The recovery is about 3 days, and the treatment is to treat symptomatically and supportively. This molecular gives you again the idea of the polyethers of okadaic acid, again a large molecule. In terms of its source, it comes from shellfish feeding on algae. The range is Japan and Southeast Asia, Scandinavia, Western Europe, Chile, New Zealand, and Eastern Canada. And again, we have heat-stable toxins, meaning that cooking is not going to diminish the level of potential toxicity. The onset in terms of diuretic shellfish poisoning is 30 minutes to 3 hours. The symptoms include diarrhea, nausea, vomiting, abdominal pain, chills, headache, and fever. The duration of this particular poisoning is 2 to 3 days with or without treatment. In terms of our food safety controls, mass bioassays, in terms of monitoring, there is an HPLC analysis, and then again, doing shellfish from approved waters not associated with these particular algal blooms. The FDA guideline in terms of okadaic acid is 0.2 parts per million in all fish, and that's okadaic acid plus 35-methyl okadaic acid. The next category is amnesic shellfish poisoning. This is due to the diatom pseudonychia species in mussels. The toxin that this presents is domoic acid. Domoic acid is a neurotoxin that acts on our amino acid receptors and on synaptic transmission. It's interesting in terms of it's different in its presentation of mode of action than the other shellfish toxins we've spoken of. This is its particular chemical structure of domoic acid. There's 8 isomers that have been identified associated with amnesic shellfish poisoning. The source is mussels, primarily feeding on algae, and we find it in the viscera of Dungeness crab and anchovies as well. The range is the northeast and the northwest of North America. The onset is GI symptoms after about 24 hours and neurological symptoms after about 48 hours. The symptoms include GI vomiting, diarrhea, and neurological conditions of confusion, memory loss, disorientations, seizure, and possibly coma. The duration is self-limiting within a few days. There's short-term memory loss that can be permanent with amnesic shellfish poisoning, and therefore you get the name of this particular poisoning syndrome. The controls associated with preventing this food poisoning have to do with analysis of mussels, HPLC laboratory procedures, and obtaining shellfish from approved waters. There is a monitoring of coastal water and shellfish associated with NOAA and FDA. The FDA guideline is for 20 parts per million domoic acid in all fish and 30 part per million domoic acid in the viscera of Dungeness crab. We've had a couple of outbreaks. The primary one in terms of the history of this particular food poisoning was in 1987 at Prince Edward Island in Canada. This was actually the first observation of amnesic shellfish poisoning. There were 156 cases in this outbreak. There were 3 deaths and then 12 individuals with permanent short-term memory loss. And again, therefore, you get the name of the syndrome. In 1981, in Washington State, there was an outbreak of 24 cases associated with razor clam consumption. The next group will start transitioning back to fish-borne toxins. We'll talk briefly here about fugu or puffer fish poisoning. This is interesting to many students in terms of its clinical presentation and its vectors. And as well, from a natural marine toxins point of view, the ability of animals to synthesize, biosynthesize, very interesting compounds, which in some cases have some applications in human medicine. Fugu poisoning or pufferfish poisoning is associated with several species of porcupine fish, ocean sunfish, and pufferfish. These fish are named this because of their ability to blow themselves up with water to make themselves look bigger in an aggressive stance with a predator. It's a food that is prepared. Fugu is a Japanese dish. It's prepared by licensed chefs. Its incidence in terms of poisoning is down because of the regulation of this particular poisoning. They have specific training that the cooks that process fugu go through. And also there's been a dietary transition more to chicken than fish in the Japanese diet. There is the desirable or the risk associated with eating a toxic meal. There is a sense of exhilaration and a euphoria, as well as the paresthesia or the tingling in your mouth and lips as you're eating this particular meal. So this is kind of an extreme food behavior, if you will. Typically, it's a fairly expensive meal when it's done by trained and licensed chefs. The active ingredient in terms of fugu poisoning is tetrodotoxin. This is a polycyclic molecule. This gives you the molecular structure of tetrodotoxin on this slide. The tetrodotoxin in terms of the fish is found highest in the organs and in the gonads. It's a potent sodium channel blocker. Clinical signs present within 15 minutes, the numbness, nausea, and respiratory paralysis that is associated with tetrodotoxin. In terms of the literature and media representations, tetrodotoxin has been associated with voodoo cults and rituals in terms of making someone, quote-unquote, into a zombie because of the amount of paralysis this particular toxin gives you. And so there's a lot of mythology and lore about its use of these dried fish products in various voodoo rituals. The source of the toxin, again, the gonads, the liver, intestines, and skin of about 80 species of pufferfish, blowfish, or fugu. It's also found in other aquatic species, including the California newt, the parrotfish, various frogs, the blue-ringed octopus in Australia, a very pretty but toxic octopus, various starfish, octopi, and various crabs also have been known for tetrodotoxin. The range, and this is an image of a pufferfish from Florida. The range is primarily the Indo-Pacific Ocean. Other cases and deaths have occurred in the Atlantic Ocean, the Gulf of Mexico, and the Gulf of California in terms of U.S. disease. The tetrodotoxin onset is about 20 minutes to 3 hours. The initial symptoms include numbness of lips and tongue. The secondary symptoms include the prickling of the face and the extremities. It's a neurotoxin, a sense of lightness and floating, some headache, some epigastric pain, nausea, diarrhea, and or vomiting. In terms of tertiary symptoms, there can be increasing body paralysis and death within 4 to 6 hours without medical intervention. The control in terms of tetrodotoxin levels in seafood, mouse bioassay for analysis, HPLC in terms of laboratory analysis, and also just an advisory not to eat puffer fish and to avoid improperly prepared puffer fish if in fact you're in Japan and decide to go to one of these licensed facilities to experience extreme food. FDA guideline is that puffer fish may not be imported except under specific authorization from FDA. In terms of the tetrodotoxin outbreaks in 1974 to 1983 in Japan, there were 646 cases and 179 deaths associated with fugu consumption. Typically, there's about 30 to 100 persons per year in Japan that come down with tetrodotoxicosis, typically from home consumption, home preparation. The mortality rate is about 50%. In 1996 in California, there were 3 cases, for example, no deaths in any of these particular cases. The next slide, what we'll do is review a case study. This is from Mortality Morbidity Weekly Report. This is from puffer fish consumption in the year 2002. In March of that year, a woman aged 65 years old was brought to the hospital by her husband. A few hours earlier, they had dined on a meal of puffer fish caught by a relative from Florida. Several minutes after eating the fish, both experienced tingling around the lips. Over the next 2 hours, the woman's symptoms worsened and she started vomiting. She developed increasing chest pain, had mild tachycardia, rapid heartbeat, and a blood pressure of 160/70. She was treated with topical nitroglycerin. During the next 4 to 6 hours, she developed an ascending muscular paralysis, so it started lower and started rapidly going up. A test of her respiratory function and carbon dioxide retention demonstrated that she had the vitals capacity of about 20% of normal. She was intubated and placed on a ventilator in terms of respiration support. She regained her reflexes and voluntary movement a day later and was extubated approximately 72 hours after presentation and discharged. The next toxin that we'll talk about is gemplotoxin. This is an interesting marine toxin in that it is typically mostly associated with extreme discomfort. It's generally diarrhea without pain or cramping. It presents in 1.5 to 36 hours after a meal is taken. The diarrhea associated with this particular type of toxin and this consumption of this the fish that have this particular oil is particularly nasty. The controls to avoid the specific fish species associated with this toxin. The outbreaks in California, for instance, in March 2000, there were 8 cases. Another associated disease with marine toxins is Fusteria complex organisms. This is interesting in that it was discovered relatively recently in 1988. It's also interesting because of the scientific debates associated with the actual vector of Fusteria in terms of its relationship to all the different life stages it has and its actual mechanism of intoxication or prey in terms of higher species. Typically, it eats other organisms, usually algae. It is a phytoplankton. Diphtheria may produce toxins that numb fish, allowing microbes to feed on the fish. But in 2002, some research challenged that hypothesis and suggested, in fact, it was micropredation, although the genetic makeup of this simple creature does not have the sufficient complexity to produce toxins. What we find is that high concentrations of Diphtheria outbreaks can develop lesions on fish and may kill them. These blooms usually exist only for a few hours. There have been associated several fish kills in estuaries along coastal Northern Carolina, and around Chesapeake Bay. And there's been some indication that the amount of nutrients from upstream animal operations is associated with these particular blooms. This graphic is a scanning electron microscopy of a Diphtheria species actually feeding. This is part of their 2002 work demonstrating micropredation. This is a fish healthy epidermis. This is the dinospore itself actually set down in terms of a peduncle on the fish skin itself and feeding on the fish. Essentially, the debate continues in terms of the role of toxins in Diphtheria. There have been no cases of seafood-borne illness associated with this. The human health effects have occurred in various laboratories, especially in East Coast universities, where some researchers were working in close proximity to some high concentrations of these microorganisms. Some of these impacts were neurotoxic, skin sensitizations. Anglers, water skiers, and fish kill monitors have complained of skin lesions, headaches, and lightheadedness, and short-term memory loss. Avoidance of Diphtheria-impacted waters, and typically Diphtheria-impacted waters are associated with fish kills, is recommended, as is just using the water as a recreational resource when Diphtheria are in bloom. What this does, hopefully, is give you, again, a fairly broad-based but introductory review of marine toxins in food. The idea in terms of presenting a safe food supply, what we've tried to do here is demonstrate that the natural ecological biochemistry, the principles of bioaccumulation, and the impacts on higher predating species, including us, can be significant and severe. Until next time, we'll see you later. Thanks much.